Chapter 29, Blame the Lettuce. April 17th, Earth. I opened my eyes and stared at my bedroom ceiling. My depression was crushing. The prophecy would not be fulfilled. Earth would continue to its imminent destruction, and it was all my fault. How could Stephen's mother have been so petty and selfish to destroy the crown of Helios rather than to lose it? And why couldn't I have been just a little faster to prevent her? I pulled my covers over my head and cried for a while. I reached out from under the blankets to get a tissue from my runny nose and froze. Someone else was in my room crying. I quickly sat up and saw my sister, Chloe, huddled in the doorway. "What's the matter, sis?" I asked as I waved her toward my bed. Chloe leaped onto my bed and wrapped her arms around me. This behavior was completely unlike her, and now I was getting scared. What was going on? Chloe sniffled and whimpered. "Something's wrong, and I'm scared, Marius." I had no idea what she was talking about, but I knew she was right when I saw the time was after 8 o'clock on a school day, and no one was screaming at us. The only noise I heard downstairs was the television and Dad swearing at his phone. Dad should have been at work, and Mom should have been chastising him for his foul language. Moreover, he rarely let us turn on the television in the morning unless there was a crisis. I strained to hear the television. Then I gasped when I heard the announcer say, "Again, everyone in the tri-state area is advised to stay in their houses until further notice. Please limit your telephone use so that channels are available for emergency responders. For those of you just joining us, there were over 3,000 unexplained deaths in the greater Cincinnati and northern Kentucky areas last night, and the numbers are expected to rise. Medical experts are at a loss at what could cause so many people to die in their sleep and are racing to determine whether this is a contagious disease." I was suddenly dizzy, nauseous, and cold. I thought I was going to faint. No disease killed these people. They were casualties from a war from their dreams that they didn't even know they were fighting. Larsa warned me that nearly everyone on Mirth is linked to someone here, but there was no way to know who they are. None of these people were conjoined, which meant that people die in both places whether they know they are linked or not. Then I realized I hadn't heard Mom at all. There should at least be the sound of clinking dishes coming from the kitchen.
"Mom!" I yelled as I raced downstairs in a panic. I nearly knocked Dad over in my rush to find her. She had to be all right. She couldn't be one of the casualties. She just couldn't.
Dad grabbed me and told us that Mom wasn't home, but that she was all right. Something terrible had happened last night, and she had gone over to Uncle Tony and Aunt Liz's house this morning. He saw me gulp and explained that Mom's brother, Uncle Tony, had died in his sleep last night. Chloe began wailing, and Dad picked her up to comfort her. I dropped into a kitchen chair and numbly stared at the television. They had a map up with black dots scattered all over it. Most deaths were centered around Cincinnati, with some as far north as Middletown and sporadic clusters throughout Kentucky. To my eyes, the groupings looked like a map of Septumculus and a handful of Latian towns. All those people had died here and on Mirth. And for what? My last memories from Mirth included seeing the crown of Helios destroyed and the Latian army about to be crushed. I couldn't stop thinking about how much I had failed everyone, and now our failure wasn't theoretical. Real people had died. I knew I had to talk to the others, but all I could get was an "All circuits are currently busy" message from the phone. Dad said that he hadn't been able to make a call all morning and that he couldn't even send text messages. We felt completely isolated. None of us knew what to do other than to sit and watch the nonstop coverage of "Health Crisis in Cincinnati." 10 minutes later, we all nearly jumped out of our skins when the phone rang. Dad almost dropped it in his haste to answer. He was hoping that it was Mom reporting in, and a perplexed expression washed over his face as he handed it to me. It was Dr. Price with one question. "Do you know what is going on?" I answered that I did, and she stopped me before I could say anything else. She was sending people to bring all the heroes to the hospital. I reminded her to bring Ms. Dada and Mr. Narwani and asked if Dad and Chloe could come along. Dr. Price agreed and added Malik and Ethan to her list. Tyler was already with her at the hospital. She instructed us to be ready to leave as soon as possible and to dress nicely. I didn't get a chance to ask why before she hung up. There was a loud bang on the door less than 5 minutes later, with a terrified policeman nervously shifting from foot to foot outside when Dad opened the door. The officer told us to follow him to his cruiser, but Chloe still hadn't come downstairs and I hadn't put on my shoes. The officer insisted that we needed to leave now in a panicked tone which sounded like our house was on fire, and Dad ran upstairs.
I slipped on my shoes, but only got one tied before Dad returned carrying Chloe, who was still in her pajamas. He dropped her clothes as he struggled to manage his thrashing daughter and told me to grab them and a pair of shoes for her. We followed the policeman out to his car and slid into the back. Chloe calmed down a bit once we were inside, and the officer turned on the siren and sped off at high speed. None of us had ever been in a police car before, and being crammed into a beat-up back seat and staring through a cage at a panicked policeman racing through the streets with a shotgun mounted next to him quieted us all down. Chloe grumbled and squirmed to change into her clothes, but I wasn't able to tie my shoe. The ride was too bumpy, and we were far too cramped. The officer escorted us to an expansive conference room on the top floor of the hospital. Nobody asked who we were or checked for IDs. They just pointed in the direction where we should go and stared at us as they tried to figure out who we were and why we were so important. Sean's and Raquel's families were already there, as were Tyler and Dr. Price, of course. Dr. Price thanked us for coming and asked whether we wanted something to eat or drink, but I didn't think any of us could have eaten anything if we tried. She then told Dad that Mom had been contacted and was on her way. 15 minutes later, everyone else was there, and a stern-looking man briskly entered the room. He sighed when he saw the families inside and instructed Dr. Price to arrange a place for them to wait. He wanted this to be a closed meeting. Well, Dad and the other parents were not about to let that happen, and the man finally relented. They compromised by moving our brothers and sisters to another room. Dr. Price assured everyone that they would be supervised with games, activities, and food, and the parents begrudgingly agreed. I think my sister was ready to be out of this stuffy room by then anyway. She was still pissed at Dad for bringing a mismatched outfit and at Mom for leaving this morning. She was grumpy, and the promise of donuts and hanging with other kids probably sounded better than sitting in a boring meeting. We were instructed to move into the room next door, which looked like a courtroom. It had a row of tables with chairs behind them at one end and another row of tables with chairs on the other side facing them. Additional rows of chairs arranged like a theater filled the rest of the room. A group of 5 serious-looking people were sitting at the tables at the far end of the room. Dr. Price and the 7 of us travelers were told to sit at the tables facing them. Everyone else was instructed to find places in the audience. The stern-looking guy stood up, cleared his throat with a cough, and started the meeting. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dr. Lars Johansson. I am the chief medical officer for this facility, and I would like to thank all of you for coming in on this most tragic morning for our city. He motioned to the woman on his left and added, You probably recognize Governor Billington. She has traveled from Columbus to personally ensure that we quickly determine the cause of this tragedy and get this crisis under control. We are also joined by Drs. Patel, Mills, and Livingston from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. Dr. Patel is their Deputy Director of Infectious Diseases. Governor Billington stood and thanked Dr. Johansson for the use of his facility. She smiled and assured everyone that this wasn't a hearing, despite its appearances. No one here was in trouble or accused of anything, and the governor was extremely grateful for our assistance. She then bowed her head and asked everyone for a moment of silence for all the people who had perished last night. I had never really met a politician in person before and was genuinely impressed. She had all the persuasive skills of a unicorn without the magical thought control. She had calmed a room of anxious people in a matter of minutes with a warm smile, a handful of well-chosen words, and a simple act of respect. Governor Billington took her seat and motioned for the rest of us to sit down as well. Her smile faded a bit as she stressed that everything discussed in this room would be confidential. Her words were firm and commanding, but her tone and body language still conveyed warmth and genuine caring. Her medical colleagues were here to determine the cause of last night's tragedy and to ensure that it was over. Her role was to calm her panicked constituents and to guide the area's grieving families in a positive direction. She could not do that if anyone in this room spread rumors, partial truths, or comments not aligned with the outcome of this meeting. Governor Billington then requested that anyone uncomfortable with these terms leave now. No one moved, and Dr. Johansson, the chief medical officer, began the inquiry. He explained how Dr. Price had taken an interest in the Cincinnati childhood curse, where handfuls of local children had been inexplicably dying in their sleep for generations. He asked her to please describe the curse and what she had discovered. Dr. Price stood up but looked as nervous as I felt. Governor Billington noticed her discomfort as well. She assured Dr. Price that they were considering all possibilities. There would be no repercussions to her reputation, no matter how outlandish her suggestions might be. Dr. Price didn't seem to believe her entirely, but saw no alternative other than to tell her story. Dr. Price explained the curse and her investigation. Then she talked about the four kids who had awakened from their comas just a few months before and looked at us. She explained how we seemed to have an answer to what had occurred and how she had been unable to disprove it nor to determine a more plausible alternative. She believed that we had all experienced a shared dream and that somehow the four comatose children had become trapped in it for several years. She added that she also believed it was possible to die from this dream and that many more people might be involved. Dr. Price theorized that something terrible had happened in this shared experience last night, which caused the city's widespread loss of life. Dr. Johansson raised his eyebrow and asked if Dr. Price truly believed that dreams and ESP were the causes for last night's deaths. He wondered, even if this far-fetched idea was possible, what could thousands of people have dreamed overnight to have such an unprecedented impact on the entire region? Dr. Price admitted that she did not know, but that she thought we might be able to provide some insight. My stomach clenched as everyone turned to look at us, and I saw I wasn't the only one nervous. Mr. Narwani and Ms. Dada looked ill as they expressionlessly sat at the far end of the table. Sean and Raquel were nervously fidgeting next to them, and Nancy and Veronica were uncontrollably weeping. I am not good at public speaking, but everyone seemed to be staring at me, so I scooched back my chair and stood up to talk. I looked at the floor while trying to form my words and groaned as I noticed my untied shoe. I finally gave up trying to organize my thoughts and started telling the story about Mirth. I talked about heroes and explained the prophecy. I told everyone about how Mirth was Earth thousands of years in the future. I summarized our adventures over the past year. I explained how Earth visitors slipped into comas when their Mirth hosts did not have enough magical energy to get them back, and how they died at the same time as their Mirth hosts. I added that I didn't know until this morning that people died even when they weren't conjoined, and that I didn't realize how many people here on Earth connect to Mirth hosts. I paused after 10 minutes of non-stop talking and was ready to be laughed out of the room. My friends looked extremely grateful that I was talking instead of them, though, and the expert panel was surprisingly silent. Dr. Patel, the deputy director, just asked, "And what happened last night?" I gulped and explained that our last dream was about the Battle of Septumculus. It was a bloody fight between two massive armies, and thousands of people had been injured or killed. I reiterated that we had no idea that innocent people would die here as well. Nancy wailed, "I killed dozens of people yesterday. I had to. We were trying to fulfill this stupid prophecy, and they were trying to kill us. I had to fight back, or they would have killed me. I am sorry. I am so very sorry. I can't believe they're dead. I thought it was all a dream." Her parents put their arms around their daughter and glared at the panel. They had no idea what was going on, but were furious with the toll it was taking on their child. Veronica's mother was doing the same thing. Veronica had fled from the table and was sobbing in her arms as well. The girl just kept repeating, "I killed them. I killed them all. They're really dead. I'm a monster," as she swayed back and forth. I quickly sat down. Nancy and Veronica's outburst had hit me like a fist. I had been focused on stealing the talisman and didn't think that Stavius had killed anyone, but I'm not sure. What if I had? What if those troops I blasted weren't just stunned? What if they were dead? I had no idea they were on Earth. I could have even killed Uncle Tony. The panelists seemed unmoved by this and asked Mr. Nawani and Ms. Dada what their roles were in all this. Our teachers explained how they also dreamed of Mirth and assured them that everything I had said was true. Then the panelists did something completely unexpected. They didn't scoff at my story. They didn't try to understand the wild tale I had just told. Dr. Patel simply asked whether we defeated the seven families and had fulfilled the prophecy. I felt weak as I remembered my failure. I was going to have to stand in front of everyone I cared about to explain how all these people had died for nothing. I couldn't do it. I just sat there and couldn't say anything. Nancy, however, jumped up and shouted, "Yes, we won the battle! The unicorns came and saved us at the end, and if they had arrived sooner, none of these people would have needed to die." Dr. Mills exclaimed, "Wait, the unicorns are free? This is disastrous!" I sat there stunned as Nancy glared at me as if this was all my fault, but something else gnawed in my mind and wouldn't go away. Why were these doctors not treating us like a bunch of lunatics? Why was this woman so worried about the unicorns? I had barely mentioned them, and how did they know about the seven families? I know I had not used that term at all in my story. I jumped up and shouted, "You believe us! You know this is all true because you've been to Mirth! You're evil Mirth agents who are trying to stop us from fulfilling the prophecy! Well, it won't work! The seven families are destroyed, the talismans are gone, and there is nothing you can do about it!"
Okay, now everyone was looking at me like I was a lunatic. Well, everyone except Ethan, Tyler, and Malik, who were in complete agreement. I was looking for a way out of the room, but didn't see any escape. Besides, where would I run? The Mirth agents already knew my identity. I wouldn't have believed that today could have gotten any worse. I was doomed.
Governor Billington stood up to declare a short recess. She added the meeting would be limited to the panel and the seven dreamers when it resumed.
Well, our parents were not going to agree to that, and neither were we. Several parents rushed to the front table, and I thought there was going to be a fight before the governor raised her hands and said, "Very well, everyone may stay, but let's take a 5-minute break to calm down." The crowd backed off, and people started to head for the door when I heard Mr. Narwani's voice tell people to wait. I was kind of surprised, because he is usually the first one to welcome a chance to go to the bathroom, but he was standing at the end of the table, refusing to move. He stared at the panel and said, "I demand to know who you are."
Dr. Johansson shuffled some papers and replied, "We already introduced ourselves. I have no desire to repeat myself for those who chose not to listen."
Mr. Darwani was not going to be intimidated. He responded, "Do not insult me by claiming that you do not know what I mean. What are your names on Mirth?"
There was silence in the room. There was absolute silence. The panel stared at Mr. Narwani as he glared back at them. Finally, Governor Billington relented with a sigh. "You would not recognize the names we currently use in our dreams."
Our parents sat back in surprise. Not only were their governor and four medical professionals accepting this fantastic tale, they were admitting being a part of it. Mr. Narwani, however, was not satisfied. He started to reiterate his demand, but the governor raised her hand to stop him. She looked at me and said, "All of us were once prophecy heroes like you. My first name is Lucille, and I was known as Luna in those days. Lars Johansson was once called Mars. Lakeisha Patel was Terra. Veronica Mills was known as Venus, and Laura Livingston was another Luna. We did not serve the prophecy together, and none of us made it anywhere near as far as you. None of our groups successfully retrieved a single talisman. We have, however, continued to assist the hero's cause from the shadows for many years. I cannot express how impressed we all are with your success."
I gulped as I looked at the five panelists smiling at us. They were former heroes, and they were impressed with us? I should have felt relieved, but I just felt like they were more people to let down when I had to come clean about losing the seventh talisman.
Dr. Mills gently asked, "And now that we have introduced ourselves, may we learn your names?"
We were all sitting in stunned silence, so Mr. Narwani began. He said, "I am Saturn, and my wife's name is Ops. I'll let the children introduce themselves."
Sean waved a little wave and said, "Hi, I'm Janice, and this is Elisa," as she performed Raquel's introduction. She saw their confused expression and added, "We had a little confusion when we were named. Raquel's proper Mirth name is Terra."
Dr. Billington smiled and welcomed them both with, "I am truly pleased to meet you both."
Nancy went next, saying, "My Mirth names are Narayana and Luna." Dr. Patel took pity on Veronica, who was still sobbing. He nodded in our direction to interject, "Which means that you must be Venus, and you are, of course, Mars."
Veronica nodded, and I added, "Yes, although we call Veronica Versera, and I go by the name Stavius."
You would have thought I had blasted them with a thunderbolt. All five panelists leaped from their seats and sent their chairs clattering behind them. They shouted in unison, "You're Stavius?" Then they proceeded to come around to shake my hand and tell stories about who they were and how they were all knew me from Lars's resistance movement.
Nancy muttered something about Stavius's undeserved popularity and the possible need for one more killing, and Veronica laughed for the first time that morning. Our families were completely confused, especially my mom and dad, and the meeting was in complete disarray.
Mr. Narwani finally got the governor's attention and asked whether we could have that bathroom break now.
Now that was the Mr. Narwani I knew.
We regrouped 10 minutes later. Governor Billington started by shaking each of our parents' hands and telling them how proud she was of us. She emphasized the importance of absolute secrecy regarding what had been shared. Then she restarted the meeting with an announcement. She announced,
it should be abundantly clear that this explanation will not suffice for the general population. Dr. Patel's team has already prepared a report. It concludes that this is likely an outbreak of a new and deadly form of listeria. Dr. Livingston has pinpointed the source to iceberg lettuce from one of the following three farms near Lexington, Kentucky. Dr. Price protested that these deaths were nothing like anything caused by listeria, most notably since they all co-occurred. She maintained that no medical professional would ever believe such a story. Governor Billington replied that it was the CDC's task to come up with a viable explanation and the data to support it. She assured us that they were very experienced at doing this and that they were extremely adept at their job. She said that the important thing was to get a preliminary answer out to the public quickly and to assure them that their elected officials were making progress. People are currently too terrified to go to sleep tonight for fear of not awakening. Telling them to throw out some lettuce is an easy and inexpensive solution to a problem over which they had no control anyway. They might not believe it, but it will give them hope, and it will be proven when no one else dies tonight. Ms. Dada interjected, "Well, no one will die tonight, but they will in 2 weeks when we dream again. There were a lot of wounded soldiers on that battlefield. Many of them are not going to survive their injuries." Dr. Patel agreed. "In a few days, we will warn people that we have discovered that this variant has a very focused latency and lifespan, which is why everyone was simultaneously affected. We will issue a warning that subsequent but less devastating generations of the bacterium may surface over the next 2 weeks. We will also mention that the bacterium has a steep evolutionary decay, which should eliminate it after that time." Dr. Livingston added, "We should emphasize the unusual, limited, and severe characteristics of this bacterium, and we should surreptitiously initiate rumors that it might be artificially created. Government conspiracies and accidentally released biological weapons will add confusion and a myriad of scenarios to thwart legitimate inquiries into our data and methodology." The governor smiled at the panel and said, "Excellent. Prepare a statement for me, Veronica. I want our response broadcast within an hour." Then she turned to me and asked, "Now, what do you need from us to fulfill the prophecy, Stavius?" I gulped again. This was it. I had to come clean, so I took a deep breath and said, "Well, can you get me a new crown of Helios?" The governor then kicked everyone out of the room except those of us who had been to Mirth. She made me explain what happened, and it felt just as bad as I had feared. Every single person in the room slumped with disappointment, defeat, and despair. Well, every person in the room except Ms. Dada, who seemed energized. She stood up and said, "Oh, cheer up, I can fix this. What we really could use is a large electric motor." We stared at her in silent disbelief as she explained, "We need a DC motor similar in size to the one we're building on Mirth, and they cost a lot of money. I've done a little research, and the Cradle of Terra is about 18 by 14 by 40 inches in size, which probably equates to a 100-horsepower motor. Those things cost at least $10,000, which is more than Satish and I have available." I couldn't believe she hadn't been paying attention and said, "But didn't you hear me? Claritia destroyed the crown of Helios. We're missing a key component for our Mirth motor. We don't need one here because we can't build one there." Ms. Dada scoffed. Don't worry about that. Ops has one. Remember that I was once a prophecy hero named Terra. My team was wiped out, but I managed to steal and hide the crown of Helios. I always believed that my sister suspected me. However, she was too busy leveraging its disappearance to build her own to care. My theft of the crown actually became her way to achieve power. I stripped off the tracking jewels and have worn the crown as a tattoo ever since. I'll extract it and give it to you when I get back to the cave on Mirth. Now, however, we need to get a motor in place and running here on Earth." I couldn't believe it. I simultaneously felt unimaginable relief and fury that she hadn't shared that information before. I risked my life to steal that crown.
Ms. Dada saw my perplexed expression and added, "I couldn't let Claritia remain in possession of the only talisman in existence. Tessup had to consider the people living in Septumculus. Mirth will continue to exist whether or not we fulfill the prophecy. Claritia would have become a dictator with that amount of unchecked power and would have subjected the Septumculan people to a level of tyranny you cannot imagine."
I silently thought that, yes, I could imagine what Staven's mother would do as the sole owner of a talisman. My memory of that power-crazed woman cradling a broken crown as though it was her own flesh and blood brought chills to my neck. Sometimes I don't understand grown-ups at all.